Hi, everybody. Welcome to Facebook, and I'm Scott Case. I'm the CEO of the Startup America Partnership, and we're here today to talk a little bit about the Startup America Partnership and to profile some amazing entrepreneurs who have done remarkable things. I want to start off just by thanking a bunch of folks. Facebook for hosting us. For those of you who were here for the president or the Women in Tech panel, they did a fantastic job. I want to thank some of our key partners, the Case Foundation and the Kauffman Foundation, helped get Startup America going. Some of our early partners, including IBM, Intel, and Facebook themselves. And then a bunch of new partners that have been announced today. We'll talk a little bit about them throughout the day, but Microsoft, American Express, Cisco, Google, HP, the Angel Capital Association, Salesforce, LinkedIn, Silicon Valley Bank, Intuit, and even Indiegogo, who have all helped do amazing stuff today. And if you look on the startupamericapartnership.org website, you can see a ton of different ways that entrepreneurs are already able to get services and resources to help them be more successful, which is really what the Startup America Partnership is all about. How do we help raise America's entrepreneurial game to the next level? And I'm joined here by, as I mentioned, some amazing entrepreneurs. I'm gonna introduce them in a moment, but I'm gonna start off by talking a little bit about the Startup America Partnership and the Startup America Initiative with Austin Goolsbee. The Startup America Partnership is all about the private sector engaging and using and leveraging the resources of America's private sector to help America's entrepreneurs be more successful. The public sector side of the equation is all about how the federal government can help reduce some of the barriers and some of the challenges for entrepreneurs and help bring some of the resources to bear that are unique to our government. So I want to start off by turning it over to you, Austin, and talk a little bit about
Well, thanks, Scott. I mean, the point of the effort was to try to get a public-private partnership going so that we accentuate a business model that everybody understands in America, that, you know, somebody's got a good idea and they turn that into a company that some years down the road, you know, it employs 100,000 people and just started in their garage. We invented that business model, and moving people from the garage to a growing company is the whole point. So you've got the private sector side, which we're going to go through to try to foster entrepreneurs like this. And then on the public side, we've tried to emphasize three additional things: the reducing of regulatory barriers for new companies, which red tape and things like that can be extremely problematic for somebody just trying to, that doesn't have the money for compliance officers and lobbyists and whatever it may be. Two, trying to increase the access to capital for entrepreneurs with the Small Business Administration putting some monies that can match venture capital or other ways to get capital to startups. And the third is tax policy, where the administration tried to, it's cut taxes, I believe, 17 times now for small businesses and people starting their own businesses. And one of those is set the capital gains rate to zero for people that that start their own companies. So on any of those, if people are interested, we have more details. On the reducing barriers, there's a website. If you go to reducingbarriers.ideascale.com, we're having some reducing barriers sessions around the country, and there are places that you can submit online. If there are, in your own industry, in your own startups, if there are things that really affecting in a negative way, we do want to know about those.
Excellent. So that's the key thing for Startup America is it's all about raising the game, helping entrepreneurs, whether it's from the government, which in many ways is one of our biggest partners and allies in this, and then really bringing the private sector to bear. I want to start off by introducing our panelists, and then we'll kind of have a roundtable discussion. Before I do that, just a little housekeeping. If you're watching this live on Facebook, you want to click on the green button that says Ask a Question. It's probably pretty straightforward, but I want to make sure everybody knows how to ask a question. Please do start posting those questions. We're monitoring them live now, and we'll be able to talk about them throughout the next 45 minutes or so. So I'll just introduce our panelists. Starting to my left, we've got Mike Schopfer, who is the VP of Engineering at Facebook. We have, let me get this, give me order right here. We have Adriana Nagu, who's the co-founder of Fromotis. We have Austin, we have myself, Scott Case. We have Lynn Jurek, who is the co-founder and CEO of Sunrun. And then to my right, we have Raisa Nebbi, who is the co-founder of a brand new startup called Spoondate, so new, in fact, that you haven't even opened yet, right?
No.
You're in the press. So I actually want to start with you to talk a little bit about kind of what it was like and to found a company and sort of how you got here, because you have a really pretty cool story. So tell us a little bit about you and your business.
Yeah, so I sort of stumbled upon entrepreneurship. I used to make a living as an investment banker and private equity banker as well. So 2 years ago, right before the financial crisis, I quit my job and decided to pursue my passion for food. So I went to culinary school, I blogged about food, I made movies about food, I worked at high-end restaurants. And it's during that time, last summer, I was in Paris working at a high-end restaurant that I realized I love food, but being in the kitchen, which is like a dungeon, doesn't really make me happy. And what really makes me happy is seeing the way people connect through food. And it's with that in mind that I decided to create, at first, a dating site that connected people through food. So I went home, booked a ticket and an apartment, and moved to San Francisco with that crazy idea, thinking that you come to San Francisco, you throw a rock, you hit an engineer, and you start a company. So you know, the reality was a bit different, but
First of all, Facebook hired solving
engineers. Exactly. And along the way, I've learned that finding a company with someone is actually harder than finding a husband. So I got lucky. I came across some really interesting program. The first organization that actually opened all these entrepreneurial doors for me was Women 2.0, which really fosters female entrepreneurship in the tech space. And out of that came a program called Founder Labs, which I joined and I used to incubate my idea. So that helped me find a co-founder, validate my idea. And a couple of months down the line, I was able to secure some angel funding and recently came out of the 500 startups company batch. So we are still early. It's been a great experience. We are operating in private beta now, which should go publicly in a few weeks. And so spoondate.com, if you're single or you like food, want to meet some people over food, check out the website.
Great. Thank you very much. So I'm going to go to the complete other end of the spectrum and talk to Mike here, who's not only the VP of engineering, but also started and sold a company a few years back. And just talk a little bit about kind of some of the cultural things that have happened for you that have really helped you be successful. Maybe talk a little bit about that company and what you're doing here at Facebook.
Yeah, it's fun because I've been able to do kind of interact with startups in a variety of different ways. I started my own company in 2000. It was venture-backed and sold it to Sun Microsystems in 2003. And so I've been through all of the funds and up and down, and it's an emotional roller coaster when you start a company, but really, really rewarding. And then now I get to work in a different way with startups, in the sense that most of the products we end up building, we run like startups. So you have five or six engineers building the world's largest photo sharing site, or enabling startups to create and build what they're doing via, you know, Facebook platform. So having people build gaming sites or other things like that. So we get to work with entrepreneurs and engineers all the time who are using the internet, using Facebook, using mobile to build the next class of great large companies. So I think it's fun to be able to interact in all those regards, and great to see the mentorship that happens in the Valley. And so I think I was telling you a story earlier about how, you know, in the 90s, the big hot internet startup was Netscape, and that was founded by, at the time, a young entrepreneur named Mark Andreessen, who was mentored by Jim Barksdale, who had been around for a long time. And now you have, you know, the hot young startup Facebook now being run by Mark Zuckerberg, with Mark Andreessen on the board mentoring him. And so you have this great tradition of people helping other people, you know, get up and get their startup going and helping the next generation. So part of what's great about this program is I hope it's a way to connect people who are just starting out, just getting their company going, with other people who are there to do it because it's fun. It's fun to work with entrepreneurs and get new things started.
Yeah, in fact, if you visit the startupamericapartnership.org website, you'll see a lot of areas where, no matter what stage you're at, you can get access to expertise of all different types to help you in that way. So it's one of the things we're absolutely focused on, is mentoring and mentorship in general. I want to bring it over to Lynn, actually, next, which you're kind of in that speed up stage right now and what you're working on. And why don't you just talk a little bit about Sunrun and kind of what you're up to and some of your challenges.
Absolutely. So if we're not your energy company at home right now, we will be in the future. That's the goal. So what we do is we buy the solar panels for you, have them installed on your rooftop, and then we just sell you the power on a monthly basis. So it's no switching costs. It's equal or less than what you pay your utility. And that's actually working quite well across 8 states today in the country. So we've been on a great growth rate. We've are building about $1 million every single day in solar power systems. And one of the things I wanted to mention to this group is, particularly when we think about the regulatory barriers and what stops us and what kind of keeps me up at night, we really want a clean energy economy that's not based on subsidies. And we can get there, and the numbers really work, but we got to reduce the cost. And so we went out and looked at, you know, how much should this cost? Let's look at a market like Germany, which has a ton of solar power. It's actually 40% cheaper to install solar power in Germany today. And that's not including subsidies. And, you know, panels are the same price, labor is the same price, you know, why is it? And as we dug a little bit further, we realized that in the United States, there's a huge unnecessary cost in high permitting fees and local regulation and variation. It actually adds about $3,000 of additional cost per system. And this is something that we could remove with a federal standard, with a race to the top type program, and actually make the clean economy a reality for a lot more Americans.
That's great. Are there some states that are working together to come up with common standards to help reduce some of that?
There are, and in fact, the DOE has identified this as a real problem and did some research and has come out with best practices. And so now we have to figure out how do we incentivize the local jurisdictions to really take those on, which is why the race to the top type of program makes so much sense.
That's a great idea. All right, so I want to bring it to our final but not least panelist, Audriana. And you're kind of at that stage where you got a product, you're not quite at the speed up, ramped up, but you've got customers. And why don't you talk a little bit about how you got to where you are and some of the lessons you've learned and a little bit about your company.
Yeah, how I got, it's been a long road. Started in Romania, that's where I'm originally from. Went to School of Engineering, have a background in computer science. Won the green card lottery, came to the United States, and started to work at Microsoft. Worked there for 10 years and did my first startup actually at Microsoft, building a new product that is currently shipping with Office, InfoPath. That's much easier than to do it outside of a company that has enough capital for that. But 5 years ago started Formotus. Our goal is to replace all paper clipboards with tablets that would run Formotus software. Tablets like iPads or Android tablets or HP WebOS tablets. We have a product out there. It's a cloud service that allows companies of any size to create, deploy, manage mobile custom business applications that connect to the customer's back-end data, whether it's in the cloud or on-premise. We work really well with Microsoft's SharePoint, but with any other back-end that has XML web services, very much based on standards. So we are now in the midst of fundraising, which is the hardest part of being an entrepreneur, I found. But it's also exciting because it's at the point that opens the doors for growing the company from a small product to be able to capture the whole market.
That's fantastic. Thanks. I just want to point out that, you know, the two of you have both sort of came to the United States for various reasons and have become entrepreneurial and built businesses. You really explicitly said, I'm out of here, I'm going to go build something in the United States, and came to San Francisco with a one-way ticket, which is bold. I think a lot of entrepreneurs, though, are. You know, we're sort of ambitious, take no prisoners, you know, make stuff happen kind of people. And that's kind of what we want to hear more about. So if you're watching online right now, two things. One is if you've got questions, please ask the questions and post them either to the wall or on that green link. And I think you've got some questions now. And then we want to hear your stories. So if you're an entrepreneur, and tell your story. You've heard some of the stories from the panelists here. Send them to info@startupamericapartnership.org. Send them as a guest blog post, and the Startup America Partnership will publish these over the coming weeks. Keep them short, because we're all like in the info tech space, so think about something that you want to read on your iPhone or your BlackBerry, not something that you want your mom to read on a long form. And why don't we take the first question? I think we're going to start online, and then if you have questions in the audience, please raise your hand, and we'll sort of select those folks. So please, go ahead.
And if for the questions from the audience, please raise your hand and we'll get a microphone to you. Our first question comes from Alex Pischeknik from Brooklyn, New York, who asks, it's challenging to keep a finger on the pulse of innovation outside of Silicon Valley and outside of the U.S. Any advice for entrepreneurs facing this challenge?
Let me see. I want to kick that over to you, Mike, since you think that the Valley has all these special pieces of it. How would you recommend someone keep track of this pace of innovation that's happening?
Well, I mean, I think this is where the internet is the great equalizer in a lot of ways, because keeping pace with things, online, how do we keep pace with things here? It's like we all read TechMeme and TechCrunch and a whole bunch of other things, and you can do that in Brooklyn too. So I think doing that online is a good way, and connecting, using all the same social media tools that you use to find friends or find, people that you have something in common with is a great way to find people who may be able to trade ideas with you, whether it's another entrepreneur who's fundraising and going through challenges and maybe has some advice, or maybe it's a mentor or someone who's been through that before and can kind of help you get through it more quickly. So, I think that using online and especially social media tools to find either the information or the people who could help you would be my big advice on how to do this.
Scott, I'd also say it may be in certain industries that there's only that the key seat of entrepreneurship, Silicon Valley. But that's, if you just look at the data, that's not true at all. There's entrepreneurship all over the country in a lot of different areas, and including in some of the internet space. I'm from Chicago. Groupon, one of the fastest startups ever, they're in Chicago. You got Washington. If you go, I know the Startup America family is branching out around the country, but I think in different industries, you see a lot of economic activity and people starting businesses all over. And they have a major net impact on the economy. So if you say the net new, everybody knows a lot of startups don't survive and you lose jobs from those. But if they add way more than they lose, so on net, that's 40 million new jobs from new companies over the 20 years of data that we have. And that's more than 100% of the job creation in the country. I mean, so this is a really significant engine for us all over the place.
Can I add one quick thing? Sorry, I think the other thing that's important about this is that all of these tools these days are two-way tools, so this isn't just about reading, but you can really use, whether it's Facebook or Twitter or blogs, to publish your message to the world. And this is how, for example, we often find really talented engineers in other parts of the world or in other parts of the country through online, through what they're writing about online, and then bring them over here and hire them. And so you can use the same techniques to either find other people yourself or to get your name out so you can get investment or get partners or whatever it may be.
You want to add something real quick and then we'll go to the next one?
A quick thing I might add is there's a lot of innovation in, hardware and technology, and particularly in the clean energy sector. That's where a lot of the early innovation came. But there's really the second wave of innovation in smart business models, really. How do you get this stuff up on roofs? How do you deploy this into the utility grid? How do you help consumers understand their utility bill? One of the examples I like to use is if you brought Thomas Edison back today, he would know how to operate our grid. That's crazy. Alexander Graham Bell would never know that. He wouldn't know how to work a smartphone. So there's a lot of things just in those business, those kind of last mile problems that aren't just technical innovation, but are smart business people can solve.
You bring up one other piece that comes to that around innovation is sometimes entrepreneurs have an idea, but collecting a bunch of entrepreneurs together and really banging around on those ideas and then taking on those big problems. So if you're not familiar with it, startupweekend.org is a great site. They're doing these startup weekends where in 3 days they'll take those kinds of problems and say, hey, let's drop in a few, two or three different ideas, and then let's get some real innovation around how do we address them. So. I'm going to take the first question we've got from our studio audience. Go ahead, just state your name and what's your question.
So I'm Manu Kumar from K9 Ventures, and I'm curious for the entrepreneurs over here. What was the moment in your life when you realized you can be an entrepreneur? So I'd just love to hear that story.
So. Why don't we start with you, Adriana?
Well, when I came to the United States, I wanted to be an entrepreneur. I wanted to have my own business, but I realized I wasn't ready yet. As I was approaching my 10-year anniversary at Microsoft, I was looking for the next challenge, my next growth in career and impact. And it was clear to me that I'm at the right place at the right time to start a new company. It was a continuation of the work that I did at Microsoft, doing forms for desktop, and I saw that mobility is going to explode pretty soon, and taking forms from the desktop to the mobile device, I realized I was the right person to do it. I had the background, I had the passion, I could understand the need. And it took 6 months to make sure that it is what I want to do and I can take that financial risk for myself and my family, and then plunged in with both feet. Didn't realize it was going to be as hard, nobody told me. But being an entrepreneur is also part of not giving up, if I were to summarize in just a few words.
Yeah, it's amazing to me how, you know, people start companies and they go, wow, this is like really hard work. Like, welcome to the jungle. It's also the case that, you know, it's getting cash is not easy, you know, getting capital isn't easy, and yet sometimes that also teaches you something about the business and how you operate it, because that's a crucible that when you make it through, you really have a great business at the end of it. How about you? What was your...
For me, it took a while because I started as an investment banker, and I come from a West African family, pretty traditional. It's get the best degree, get the best job, be the best employee you can be. So risk is not something that's highly encouraged. So I joined Wall Street, was making a pretty lucrative living at an early age. And, you know, I got to a point where I realized that, you know, the money wasn't doing it for me anymore. And I just wasn't happy, and I kept wondering, what was I living as a legacy? What was motivating me? What value could I contribute to the world and the people around me? And for me, that was food. So I knew that whatever I did would be in the area of food, but I wasn't really sure how. So I kept iterating on many things, cooking at a restaurant, blogging, making documentaries, until I finally found that the right thing, and that was connecting people through food by using the internet.
That's great. So, do you want to answer?
Yeah, I was just going to tell a story. I'm on leave from the business school, the University of Chicago, and the MBA students are there. There was a kid was from, I think, Germany, and had come to the U.S. and wanted to start a company in the U.S. And another kid asked this kid, why did you come here? And he said, well, the thing is, where I'm from, I have this idea, if I tell people in my hometown I'm thinking of starting a business to do this, everybody's got a reason not to do it. They said, that'd be a terrible idea. You could lose your job. Everybody will, you'll embarrass yourself. You'll never get another job again.
Why are you looking at me so intently?
Because you're toast. I'm giving you the warning. But he said in America, it was the opposite. It was almost too much. Everywhere he went, people said, that's a great idea. I know a guy who would like to fund that. You know, can I be your co-founder? You know, and I do think there's a little bit of there's a culture of this place, certainly Silicon Valley, the place, but the U.S. in general has very high entrepreneurship motivation, and you should not underestimate how important that is.
Absolutely critical. So you have a next question there? Before you go to the next one, hang on 1 second. So I just want to ask the panelists, especially the three of you who are like right in the fray of starting a company now, what are some of the kinds of tools and resources that have helped you build your business? I mentioned a myriad of companies that have made commitments, whether it's Cisco or it's HP or it's Microsoft. You talked a little bit about being alumni. What are some of the things that you guys have used to help you grow and build your business? And I'll start with you, Len. Yeah, are there some specific tools or companies that you've worked with that have really helped you get where you are?
Yeah, absolutely. There's, you know, you don't need to reinvent the wheel. As a startup already, you have a point of differentiation and something unique. You want to focus all your energy on that and leverage everything that's out there and people have done before. You know, for example, Salesforce. We used Salesforce as early as when we were just three employees. We used Microsoft. We had some help with QuickBooks. You know, there's this whole ecosystem of tools that are pretty affordable. And, you know, now with on-demand and other type of resources and the resources certainly that Startup America brings. And that was very helpful in us just focusing on what's our core differentiation and just getting everything else in to help support that.
Right. Don't be distracted by all those things in the back end that don't really help you build your business out.
That's right.
How about you from your perspective?
Yeah, there are a lot of resources out there. Being in the back backyard of Microsoft, we joined the BizSpark program, which helps entrepreneurs and startups with resources, not of just software, but also with one-on-one coaching to find creative ways to help startups navigate internally the Microsoft organization, but also in presence to different events that bring exposure to startups. There are organizations that help startups like Astia, catering to women entrepreneurs, and that's been also very helpful to network, especially in this area.
Great. And I know you're just in the middle of it, but what are the types of things that you've built your business on?
We're pretty young, we're pretty scrappy, so for us, existing distribution platform have been a huge advantage, and by that I mean the Facebooks, the Googles, especially in the early stages when you're trying to validate an idea. Simple keyword searches or simple ad campaigns on Facebook have been really instrumental in helping validating what the real needs that what some of the needs that our target users had, and make sure that we're addressing those in the development of our product. Google, definitely we use that for some keywords, some AdWords searches, AdWords campaigns. We have a Facebook page, so we use that to engage with our users, in addition to Twitter. And in terms of other like resources, like professional resources, I'll go back to Women 2.0 and Founder Labs, which have been really helpful in leading us to the right people who could help us with coaching and access to professional resources, talking to people who knew the industry that we're going into and share knowledge and best practices.
The other thing I would add is all these tools help you feel a lot bigger than you are, which is pretty important. You know, I think we have that advantage as being startups in this ecosystem. So, you know, when we got started, we had a major chicken and egg problem. We were buying these $50,000 solar systems that we were going to own on people's roofs for 20 years. We had to convince banks to give us hundreds of millions of dollars to buy all these. We had to convince consumers we were going to be around for 20 years to actually take care of this. And we had to convince solar installers that, hey, people want it this way. They want it as a service. They don't want to buy the panels. And so we use a lot of these tools to make ourselves feel professional and that we'd be around for 20 years, which is a lot easier than I remember early on. I made my husband, I think, even come in when we had important meetings, so it just looked like we had more bodies in the space. It's nice to not have to do that anymore.
That's great.
And
that's
I was going to say, especially for young consumer web startups, Facebook is such a huge resource, a huge network to tap into in terms of finding the people you're looking for. You're looking for people in your 20s in San Francisco who like food. You can get those people and find them in 5 seconds and tap into that resource to see if your idea even sticks with some people.
So a big part, just on the like the customer acquisition piece mm-hmm. of things, a big part of what Google has announced today is the access to up to $100 million in basically AdWords for Startup America firms to be able to tap into those resources early on, to be able to start to, whether it's testing an ad campaign or driving traffic to those pieces. And then you mentioned about Facebook. A lot of the stuff that Facebook's doing is helping small companies like yours build applications that sit on top of the Facebook. And there's a couple of dates coming up for startup developer days that are coming here in Palo Alto to help you build those kinds of applications. And I have one question, speaking of avoiding pain on the back end. Any of you guys use American Express cards to track your expenses and download your pieces of the puzzle? I know for all the businesses I've started, it's a really important thing to make sure that stuff gets tracked properly, because there's nothing worse than having your auditor or accountant come in and say, now exactly how did you expense all this stuff?
Yep.
Having it all in one place is a great tool, and a lot of the things that American Express is committed to today is helping all kinds of startups get access to all of their tools for free. And that's pretty much true of all of the commitments that were made today, is big companies stepping up and helping the new companies in America take it to the next step. And so you should really try to access all those resources, because to your point, and this is advice I usually give to lots of entrepreneurs, way better spending time and energy and resources on your product development, on the things that make you special, than on the things that make you crazy. I'll take the next question from online. And again, if anybody in the audience has a question, come on up.
This one's from Neil Tingey in Houston, Texas, who asks, why is investing in innovation so important? In these tough economic times, isn't it risky spending money on the unknown?
Wow. I'm going to let you handle that one, Austin.
How risky is it not investing in the unknown? I mean, the thing is, when you go through a downturn like the one we went through, it's very scarring. Usually the thing that everybody skimps on is their investment, because they say, we don't have the money, we can't do this. And that's a big, big mistake. Now, it turns out almost half of the Fortune 500 was started in a recession. And that recessions are far less than 50% of the years in this country. You know, you got a bit of a thing like the dinosaurs, you know, your meteors come in and all the dinosaurs die, and then the mammals, you know, can make a go of it. You know, there is a bit of that with startups. When you go through rough patches, oftentimes it's exactly out of the most traumatic economic episodes that are some of the best times to start, and some of the most disruptive in the positive way ideas come about. So, you know, nobody can truly predict the future about investments, but I do know that if you look at the past, coming out of experiences like this are exactly when you would want to be making those kind of investments.
And I'll come to you in a second. You also see that the companies that are outperforming right now, especially even the largest companies, are the ones who retrenched and made really significant investments back 3 years ago and said, this is an opportunity for us. And that's true for entrepreneurs. So Adriana, then I'll come back to you, Lynn.
So innovation actually means to find ways to do things better, more affordable, with less errors. So it's normal in a time of recession, when you look at your costs, taking paper forms. Bayview Plaza Pharmacy, one of our customers, were using paper forms for audits by their insurance companies. Using Formotas, they took 5 days of work to 2 hours. So that's a big cut. It makes those companies more nimble.
Yeah, just a very quick comment. So, you know, also if the big companies aren't investing at that time, it's a real opportunity for entrepreneurs, because when you come out of that cycle now, they're looking for, what did they miss? Did they miss the next product cycle? And it's, you know, ripe for a home for your startup.
Yeah, there's a big advantage to being scrappy and taking advantage of those times. Do we have any audience questions, or do you want to go back to the web? No? Yes? Okay. Great.
We have another question from the audience. It's from Jimmy Simpson in Houston, Texas. And he asks, what should be done institutionally and on a community level to encourage and motivate entrepreneurship in high schools and colleges?
Mike, you want to take that one?
Well, one thing I think that should happen is, and I think the president talked about this earlier today, is really investing in science and math education. Because I think if you look at most of the innovative businesses that have happened in the last, you know, 20, 30 years, most of them have been started by or have people around them who are doing some form of fundamental science, math, or engineering. Even if the business isn't engineering and it's a creative business model around that, you know, that requires the same problem-solving skills that you get out of a science and engineering education. So I'd actually say the number one way to do it is to actually get more people excited about math and science as early as possible in the education career, all the way up from middle school through college. And I think that will naturally actually create a lot more entrepreneurship.
The best advice I ever got was from my dad, I'll give him a shout out, was to be an engineer. Because I was like, I'll just go start something. You know, I got plenty, I'm not a program, I'll just make something happen. He said, go spend 4 years learning those basic skills, because you have them and you get to leverage them everywhere. And whether it's trying to end malaria in Africa, which is what I spent the last 4 years doing, all that stuff applied, those problem-solving skills, the excitement of the whole thing. So do you want to add a comment, either of you?
I had a comment on the earlier question about
it.
Innovation. I was going to say innovation comes at many different levels and in different ways. And there's a saying that goes, out of adversity comes opportunity. Especially for us young companies, we have the advantage of being very agile. So before the time between an idea is created and the time it's executed or implemented is really short, because we can't just wait around, so we have to create things on the go. So innovation is not always capital intensive. It really comes with just great ideas and thinking of ways to make processes better.
Great. Well, and I'll just give one other shout out to those. We get a lot of questions from people who come in. I don't know if you're seeing it on the stream, but I just need money for my idea. And sometimes that's true. A lot of times you need a lot of other things before anybody should give you a dime. But when you're ready, there's a couple of platforms out there. One is a partnership that we launched today called with Indiegogo. If you go to Indiegogo.com, it's all about raising small amounts of money to get your product developed and being able to do it in a really quick way and raising $25,000 or $50,000 to get that first product out there once you've got those core ideas. So there's a lot of tools that help you get access to capital. Did you have a question?
We heard in the previous panel, the Women in Tech panel, that only 8% of tech companies are started by women. Curious if any of you have thoughts on ways that we can kind of encourage and motivate women to be more entrepreneurial and encourage innovation in that community.
Well, as a guy, I'm not going to touch that question. Why don't you start it, and then you, I'd love for you guys to weigh in, too. Sure.
So encouraging women to be more entrepreneurial, I think women are wired to be entrepreneurial. Women, you know, give birth, raise their kids, they need to make sure that everything is in place for the future, instill good values, make sure that the children go out in the world with the right message. So I don't think women need to change the way they are to be entrepreneurial, but it's more to recognize their contribution and help them succeed in what they're doing. So we don't need to change women for that. That's my opinion.
I'll start with a metaphor. I always tell people that I look at the, again, food is the theme in my life. So I always look at the world in terms of food, and when I look at it, everybody, everything is a small dish. I want to take a small bite off and taste it. And I think that's just the way we should look at it. I mean, there are lots of opportunities out there, and you just have to jump in, dive in, and go for it. And someone said in the earlier panel that women have a harder time owning that success. And just get up, believe you're awesome, and you're a rock star. You can do it. Go. And you have so much to contribute. And there, what you create matters. There are people there to use it, to refer it to their friends, to listen to it. So I think just getting up and doing it is my advice. Do not let anything refrain you from doing so. I mean, I, for example, I'm a woman, I'm a minority. So, you know, in the grand context of things, I could have a lot of things against me, but you don't let that stop you. You go and you conquer the world, and if you're willing to work hard and contribute good ideas, people will be there to support you, and that has been my experience, and that's what I tell anyone.
Cool. Lynn, you want to?
Sure. I think, you know, Sheryl Sandberg's TED Talk is great. You know, I think it applies to entrepreneurship as well. And one point she makes is make your partner a partner. And I think this was one of the things that really helped me early to actually get comfortable starting Sunrun was my husband and I made a pact that we would approach our careers as a portfolio at all times. And we would talk to each other and we would do it together. And so we said at one point, we both wanted to be entrepreneurs. So we were in business school. We said, okay, whoever finds the right idea first gets to do it in this phase, and the other person has to take a job and support it. And then if vice versa changes, the other one has to support the other person. And so we made that agreement. So when I found Sunrun, we got started. He supported me. After 3 years in, when we were successful and I was making a nice salary, he now is starting a company. And so he, it's funny, there's a little role reversal because I'm in solar construction, of course, and he is starting a skincare company now.
That's good.
You guys should be in good shape.
You'll be in good shape. You'll both have customers for life.
I'd like to add one more thing. Someone said something really important in the last panel is that do not believe that because you're a woman, you need to surround yourself only by women mentors because there's so much to learn from anyone. And so if you have male mentors around you who are dedicated to your success and want to push you, propel your career to the next level, do so, and do not necessarily wait for just women to be around you because, you know, anyone can help you succeed.
I was just going to add exactly that, which is the advice I give whether any entrepreneur when they're first starting out, whether that's because they're 20 years into their life and they've decided to do this or they're right out of college, is join a startup. Be there early on. You're going to learn a lot from that experience. So you don't always have to step out as the founder. And effectively what you did with your, in this case, your spouse, was to sort of say, okay, you know, I'm going to step out as the founder, but you're really going to be there with me on this journey. And joining a startup is a great way to get that first order level of experience, because that's how we all started. You know, very few people start that. I don't know what you whether it was the first company you started or not, but I know from my experience it was always about finding somebody really, really smart who's doing something pretty cool and succeed or fail. Let's follow them around for a while. Do we have another question coming from the?
Plenty of questions coming in from
Great.
The audience. This is actually a policy question, and it was from Keith Kurter, who asked on Facebook, last weekend Alan Greenspan said on NBC Meet the Press that we should have the Bush tax cuts expire. For entrepreneurship and startups, would expiring the Bush tax cuts be detrimental?
Well, there are many different parts of the Bush tax cuts. They were very expensive. The president's made no secret that he doesn't think, and you heard him say at the Facebook town hall just a couple hours ago, he doesn't think going back to the rates that existed in the 1990s for people making more than $250,000 a year was especially detrimental to entrepreneurship and business activity during the 90s. He doesn't think we could afford it in the 2000s when we made it, and he thinks that they ought to expire. I would say there are some tax cuts that were in the Bush tax cuts, and some that Obama himself came up with, which do strike me as fairly important and the president has said doesn't want to get rid of. So number one, the part that's geared toward just ordinary Americans in the middle class, the 2000s was the first expansion in U.S. economic history in which the middle class family income fell by $2,000 over the course of a boom. So normally the middle class family in America does about as well as the economy is doing. And this time it diverged quite significantly. And that was even before the recession. Then you add the worst recession in 75 years. I think there is an argument that raising taxes on the middle class at this moment would perhaps be self-defeating to our recovery. And the second, as I said at the beginning of this, Obama has tried to focus on cutting taxes significantly for small business and for startups. And there again, I wouldn't think we would necessarily want to let those ones expire. But at the high end, to go back to the 90s, I don't think it would be overly detrimental.
I'll just add that for a lot of new companies, as a fact, when you're in the startup, the last thing you need to worry about is paying taxes. And by the way, if you have to start worrying about paying taxes, you are doing gangbusters, right? Because you're usually reinvesting so aggressively in the business to grow the business, you're out seeking capital. By definition, if you're seeking capital, you're not paying any taxes because you need fuel to grow. And if you can grow from the fuel that you're already driving in, you're still not going to pay taxes because you're reinvesting. So it's actually a positive thing to have these new companies driving this, because they're creating an employment, which is a huge builder of the tax base and all the net new jobs like you described. We have an in-person question. Go ahead.
Hi. It seems like timing and mapping that to market demand is really crucial to success. When you're first starting out and there's not much demand, when do you say, you know what, I'm not listening to the market? And when do you say, you know what, the market isn't listening to me?
Well, I'll tee that up and then I'll let you guys think about your answers to that. Usually if you don't have demand, you've got a fundamental issue you better address, at least in terms of your early tests and how you go about thinking about your customer. And then sometimes, though, you've got to figure out how to tell your story. So a lot of times it's not so much that the product's not a good product, it's about, did you tell the story in a way that was compelling to people who wanted to buy it? So from the first lesson I learned was what I call the engineer's field of dreams problem. So if you know the Field of Dreams movie, the main line in that movie is, if you build it, they will come. And that turns out to be completely false. And that was the first lesson I learned in my startup, was it didn't matter that I had the world's greatest product. Nobody knew about it, and we couldn't tell our story. So That my answer to that question, but I'd love to hear from you guys in terms of how you tell your stories. I don't know, Mike, if you want to weigh in on your experience.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is you have to pick it. You can't pick the whole world as your market, right? You have to pick a subset of the market that you understand. Maybe it's people who really enjoy food. You know, for Facebook, it was colleges was the first market. When it first started out, it was Facebook on the college campus, and college students was the target market. And so it was really easy to understand that demographic and whether the product worked and see how it worked in that college environment. And then it's a question of market expansion. You know, did the same product that worked on a college campus actually work for the rest of the world? And I'll tell you, when that decision was made, it wasn't obvious at the time whether it would or it wouldn't. And so you're really stepping off into the void, which is, I think, the definition of entrepreneurship, is you have a thesis that you're trying to test in the market, and you need to kind of go for it and see. It's hard to say how long, you know, not 10 years, you know, not 2 days. Like, you need to give it long enough so that you're actually trying it and figuring out whether it works. But if you can do it in a contained way, then you can use that data to iterate. Almost all the successful products made huge changes as they went because you tried it out and your first idea usually is not going to work. And then you try it and it doesn't work and you try and figure out why and then you iterate from there and get to something that does.
So what are you doing right now to do that? Because you're right in the throes of it, right? You think you got a good idea, but how do you know?
Yeah, so focus is really important, really understanding who your target market is and going after that. We'd love to have everyone, but we can go after everyone. So our focus is really on women. So I'm making it easier for women to meet people on the internet, whether it be for dating or for social purposes, like you're new to town or you're traveling. As a woman, when I go online to a dating site, I often feel I'm part of a meat market, which does not make me feel good about myself. So how do I create a curated community where women can go and bond with other people over food? We all eat 3 times a day, so it's definitely incorporated in our daily routine. So using that to create a very simple and easy way for women to meet other people on the internet.
Do you want to make one comment or do you want to take a question?
Sure. I'll make a quick comment. So I completely agree with Mike that you have to get a product out there very quickly to see if there's real demand for it. And then the way you make that judgment call is you have to be the person yourself talking to the consumer and feeling it. So just like Raisa is saying, you know, part of, I think, why Sunrun was successful and why we figured it out and tweaked the product right was because I was out there, you know, selling it. I, you know, left my venture capital job to literally selling the first Sunrun solar system at the county fair in the agricultural center, you know, next to the giant pumpkin. I mean, and that's how I got the feedback to know how to tweak and that the market was really there. And you can feel it, because I think so many people are tempted sometimes, hire the business development person, talk to marketing, and they don't know it themselves as the entrepreneur.
There's an old philosophical conundrum from academics. It's either Aristotle or a Calvin and Hobbes cartoon that says...
Probably both.
Yeah, maybe both. Everybody wants to be in the right place at the right time. But that's impossible. So just find the right place and just sit there until the right time happens, and then you're in business.
Well, it's funny because I ran into Mitch Kapoor, and for those of you who know him, he's pretty iconic. And here he is carrying around an iPad, right? And 20 years ago, he essentially invented that notion of tablet computing, but he was way ahead of the curve. So it's sometimes that actually is true. It's where does the technology drive you? Why don't we take a couple more questions from online?
Absolutely. This one is from Larry Marcus in San Francisco, who says, so many of the great United States companies were venture funded. Should anything be done to create incentives for venture capital investing?
So I'll give you just a fact, and then I'd love to see it. We got a couple of people who were venture capitalists at various times, so maybe you guys can talk a little bit about it. But it turns out that actually a very small percentage of companies, it's somewhere around 15 or 20%, actually ever get venture funding and still have become giant companies. So it's a little bit of a notion of, you think that the venture capitalists have the money and therefore you sort of have to go to them, when in reality most of the company, the vast majority of the companies actually are bootstrapped in one way or another. They get angel investments. One of our partners is the Angel Capital Association. There's literally 8,000 angels out there that make investments between $25,000 and $250,000 to get those companies to that next level. And if you can build a business, and certainly in the infotech space, oftentimes you can build platforms and build something on top of Facebook where you got huge margins there and you can make it there by just getting over the hump and building your business from the resources that you generate on your own. But I'd love to hear from the sort of the VC folks and how you sort of think about how you might be encouraged to build either bigger funds or put more money to work at different stages. So I'll take a show of hands. Who wants to take the first shot at it? Mike?
Well,
ex-venture capitalist?
No, I've never been a VC, so.
Okay.
Well, was a question to give more incentives to VCs.
Yeah, as if they needed more.
I think it's the same thing that entrepreneurs face is you have to have a good idea and you have to prove it. And there's enough tools out there right now, and particularly the tools that we're aggregating through this program, Startup America, that you can get something out there very quick. And there's enough capital that's available without any additional incentives for the good ideas to get funded. And it would be, I think, dangerous to, you know, flood that with too much capital and fund poor ideas. You know, it's a market.
It's been a tough market. The VC industry has had a tough decade. And in the digital space, you've had the kind of getting them squished on both sides. So the barriers to entry for startups have come down. So there are far more startups. And the exits on the other side have gotten more and more difficult. So now the company's got to be really big to go public. Right. And so in that, well, that wedge has gotten a little wider. So it's been a... It's been a rough 10 years or so for the industry.
The M&A activity's picked up, and there's a lot of opportunities. There's a lot of companies that are acquiring other businesses, and those are the types of things that sort of drive the market at some level, and make the overall market a little bit more efficient in some ways, because you've got an opportunity to have multiple ways out. I always tell entrepreneurs, build a great business and you'll figure out how to have an exit, and that's the same thing. If you've got a great business, there will be capital that'll be available to help you grow it. I think one of the pieces has come up on the mentoring side. I'll just bring it up on the hyper-network side. If you look at the density of connections in Silicon Valley, you talked about throwing a rock and hitting an engineer. That's actually available in a lot of different marketplaces, and we have some powerful tools. So one of our partners is LinkedIn, and leveraging a tool like LinkedIn to actually cultivate and curate the network of people that are already around you to get them to care about you, whether it's to test your product or to get access to capital or get exposure to potentials, I think it's something like the whole planet's connected 3 degrees separated. You can sort of get to anybody. And with like 100 million users on LinkedIn, you probably can get to everybody in only 1 degree. But you got to leverage that and curate it. And it's not just cold calling and reaching out and saying to a venture capitalist, hey, fund my deal. It's actually, when you start the company, curating those relationships using platforms like LinkedIn or Facebook to get those kinds of relationships ahead of time so they actually know about what you're at. I think we have time for maybe one or two more questions. Yep. Okay, cool.
Any other audience questions? Great. Well, we'll take another one from online then. And this is from Sam Zhu, who's in Palo Alto, California, who asks, what is the best way for a young entrepreneur, say 20 years of age, to find investors that would at least give us a chance to pitch your idea or product?
I'll open it up to the floor. Anybody want to take the first crack at it?
I can share my experience because I came with an idea. I didn't really know where to start, but there's something awesome in San Francisco called Startup Digest. It's actually everywhere in the US and in some other countries as well. So it's a newsletter that gives a list of all the tech events happening in the area. So I'd say start by going to events, network with people, and meet people that way, because from my experience, investors take referrals from trusted relationships. So those are sometimes their fellow investors or entrepreneurs in their portfolio. So if you can prove yourself and earn the respect and the trust of some entrepreneurs or some investors, then that makes it easier to make your way to investors you want to talk to.
And be authentic.
Yeah.
You know, if you really are a startup and you're in alpha, like, be real about it. Hey, I just got my product out the door. That's a very different place to be than if you're in a hyper-growth mode and you've raised however many hundreds of millions of dollars that you've raised. You know, those are a different platform. Good, Mike.
Especially if you're building on the internet. I mean, these days with open source tools and cloud platforms where you can get it hosted without ever having to buy servers, you can get very, very far without having to spend very much money. So I think the first test is, don't come with a slide deck. That's what you did in the 90s. You know, come with a working product, ideally with people using it. Because the first test is, can you throw the rock and hit the engineer? Can you code it yourself, or can you find someone who maybe works on the side to get you up to a demo? Because now you're proving you have what it takes to scrap it together, and the money is just an accelerant on what you're already doing, as opposed to, hey, once you give me the money, then I'll figure the rest of this stuff out. So I think that as far along as you can get without actually raising investment will make the investment part a whole lot easier for you to
be able to get into that platform. Do you want to make one comment and then we'll take one more question? Okay, then we'll wrap up.
So for new entrepreneurs, need to understand that it's really hard to build a business and you need to network a lot and have a lot of support system, mentors, that can help you, guide you, introduce you to other people, help you validate your idea in the market. So,
definitely a key thing is to build a partnership around you to be successful. Let's take one more and then we'll wrap up real quick.
Great. So our final question is going to be from the internet, and then afterwards we've gotten about 6 or 7 questions, Scott, just asking you about how people can get involved in Startup America.
So
you close at the panel, we'd love for you to share how people can connect with the effort. This one's from Jessica Adams in Austin, Texas, who asked, how can the startup attitude also apply to non-tech companies or even things like government or nonprofit organizations?
All right, so you guys all got that question. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to let you guys each make one last comment, incorporate that into it, and then go from there. So we'll start with you.
The startup really starts with creativity, identifying a problem and offering a solution to it. So sometimes that's in tech, oftentimes it's not. So many of the small businesses in America are not tech companies. So really find out if it's a bakery, maybe there's a need for bread in that area. That's what you do. So it's really finding the problem and offering a solution that's appropriate to that problem.
I think not being afraid of failure is something that's really powerful. So one of the benefits, I think, of being an entrepreneur is you hear all these stories, 7 out of 10 companies fail. So it's okay to fail. And I think if we had that idea and that comfort with it in other sectors of the government and larger organizations, that would be really powerful.
Both of you are actually building businesses that are simply enabled by technology, right? You're not actually, it's not high-tech, info-tech, it's actually information technology enabled stuff. Austin, your thoughts?
Look, I'd just say it's the adaptability. If you, in the economic data, the U.S.'s strength has always been our ability to adapt to the newest technologies. Some of those are in the tech space. A great many of them are not. We've actually been by far the highest productivity and highest growth in our service sector, as well as financial, health, you know, education, a bunch of other sectors. And I think if you talk to a lot of people, both successful and unsuccessful, at the end of their careers, if you get executives who've been business mentors, they say it was really fun. They really enjoy. As they look back on their careers, they are in some sense the most proud of when they went out and tried it. They said, well, you know, sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't, but they remember that as kind of the peak of their business life.
So being an entrepreneur is about being a problem solver and also keeping the balance between the vision that you have for your solution versus what the market tells you. And know when to really go with your vision because the market isn't there yet, but you believe in what you have, or you get feedback from the market that needs you to adapt your vision and be at the right place sooner rather than later.
Mike?
Yeah, I mean, I think being an entrepreneur is basically relentlessly attacking an important problem until you either succeed or fail, and adapting along the way. And I think that spans technology and government, and just no matter, even if you 100 people in front of you tried it and all failed, you've got a different tack on it, you think you're a little smarter than the next person, you're just going to keep running at that problem until you prove that it's impossible or you succeed. And I think you can take that approach to any number of different things, including government.
I think entrepreneurs are the ultimate problem-solving machines. You know, we just kind of keep driving against it, so that's great. Well, first let me just thank everybody on the panel here. You've all told amazing stories. I look forward to watching you as you guys build your companies. And you know, one of the ways that people who are watching online or watch this after the fact can get involved is by sending your own stories into info@startupamericapartnership.org. We also have www.startupamericapartnership.org as our website. There's opportunities for you to identify resources that you think could be helpful to you. If you're a resource provider, get involved and tell us more about your stories and tell us about more of the services and the resources. And I just want to start off by thanking the White House. I know when I listened to the president talk at the State of the Union this year, I was really impressed by the notion of actually embracing entrepreneurship because it is a core value for the United States. And the fact that the White House has really stepped up in a big way, not only on the policy side, but bringing in the partnership. And then just Steve Case and Carl Schramm, they run foundations. They're about as unfoundation-like as any foundation I've interacted with. And in fact, it's one of the reasons why I took this, because I spent a lot of time in foundations in other parts of my life. And these guys are really running businesses that happen to be using capital in a really innovative way. And the Case Foundation and Steve under his leadership, and certainly Carl at the Kauffman Foundation, have been driving entrepreneurship their entire lives. And as a guy who spent his whole life being an entrepreneur, it's really great to be able to work on this and help raise all of our game. So please visit the website. Please participate in any way that you can. You're going to see a lot more resources coming from Startup America. We're going to be doing things around the country. So we're already looking at places, whether it's upstate New York or it's Connecticut or Michigan or Illinois. We've got great partnerships that are emerging around the country to bring a lot of the resources you've seen at a national level today, become driven hyper-locally to bring those resources together. So I want to thank everybody for watching online. I want to thank everybody who is here in the audience. Let's give a round of applause to our panelists. Great job, everybody. Okay? And that's it. Thank you all very much. And we'll look forward to seeing you all around the country, because we're all on airplanes. Thanks, everybody.